Chapter 47. They placed the candles in a ring around the sleeper's coffin. Abigail was busying herself with an immense chalk diagram, which took some time because she had to put her red numbed fingers back in her glove every few minutes, or have her hands warmed between her husband's. Harrowhark drew wards at the apex of each candle, as instructed, squatting beside the smiling, no longer intubated face of Dulcie Septimus. No snow down here. Great icicles like stalactites seemed poised to crumble. Oily pink webbing was strung from spike to spike, frosted up with cold. Drifts of broken glass and stagnant puddles of frozen fluid filled each corner, greeny-greyish in the dolorous buzzing overhead lights. Ropes of tube and ice hung over the entrances to each radiating passage in that non-agonal room, swagging over the signs that had once proclaimed each passage's use. The only letters visible beneath the sluggish, pulsing viscera were a Y, the PR that had once heralded preservation, the AR once belonging to mortuary, and an almost entirely obscured 3. The crystal coffin in the centre of the room was misted thickly with cold that did not wipe off even when Lieutenant Dias, a woman Harrow was beginning to grudgingly admit feared neither pain nor death after experiencing both, scrubbed at it with her sleeve. As such, they could not see inside it, which was probably a relief. The enormous old metal-rimmed whiteboard, with its faded timetable and stained brown patches, had been written over again. Harrowhark had startled when she first saw it. End of the line. Falling. Oxygen can't last the distance and won't redirect power from the payload. Instead, I will make you watch every moment as I get the last privilege you cannot enjoy, you bygone son of a bitch. I hope you're both as sorry as I am. She had said to Ortis, I thought the messages were hallucinations, even though I never hallucinated like that before. It was easier to believe I was succumbing to the madness again.
Harrow, he had said, I have come to the conclusion that you were never mad, though who can be the judge of madness?
It seemed so much worse to her if it wasn't madness. She'd hate if it was under her control. She found herself saying curtly, Then what?
The mind can only take so much pressure before it forms indentations, he had said meditatively. It is strange. Years and years after his death, I so often heard the sound, the way he pushed at the handle, the way he manipulated the haft of my father, standing outside the door of my cell.
Harrow had asked, Did you miss him? He had thought about it. In the darkness of the big central room in that downstairs installation, the place he had never come to before, and that she felt she had left so much of herself inside, despite the fact that she had walked its metal-panelled halls for a few weeks only, he looked like an old statue, a ninth house cavalier carved in the rock of some deep-set tomb. And he had said thoughtfully,
Sometimes I imagined him coming back to life so that I might watch him die myself. The fantasy was a relief.
Now Harrowhark dropped to her haunches next to the ghost of the seventh house necromancer as she carefully fashioned wards using the blunt end of a needle. Everyone but Harrow had presented themselves to Abigail to have wards scratched on their palms. She was embarrassed by how long it had taken her to realize that they were counter wards and that she did not need one. They were the dead. For now, she was alive. Dulcie mistook Harrow's expression as curiosity over the missing tube, and she tapped one nostril and said brightly,
We thought I didn't really need it. I'm not breathing at all badly. Abigail and I suppose that we enforce some measure of our own rules here. That's why I'm not too badly off.
Harrow said, That would explain why you were affected by physical stimulus, why you have needed to eat, and why you experience pain.
Yes, and I always believed that so long as I got 8 hours sleep, did some stretches, and didn't think about it, I wouldn't get any worse, said the adept, and she smiled, that dimpled, wasted smile that was the only thing that Kithareya had come close to parodying with any accuracy. She said, Pal always said I'd be the death of him, and I was. He and I never even got to meet. I never even really got off roads. It seems like such a bastard. You did kill the lictor, didn't you?
Yes, said Harrowhark.
Was it quick?
Quicker than she deserved, said Harrow.
She stabbed Protesilaus before he'd finished taking his sword out the scabbard, she said, and scratched a flourish into her ward. Then she started asking me questions. Who were my friends? Was I well enough to go out in public? Was I married? I told her a lot of hot bullshit, finished Dulcie. I knew she was going to take my place. Thought maybe Camilla at least would figure out something was up. No such luck. I don't even remember dying. I suppose that was nice of her.
There was no resentment in that face, worn out before its time, heavily lined with the marks of pain and care. With her close-cropped curls and soft eyes, Dulcie Septimus in some lights looked like a child, in others older than Magnus. She had a tip-tilted grin that showed little white teeth, and nowhere in that smile was a hint of pity, nor of condescension.
I don't understand why you're here, said Harrow, throwing her house's caution to the wind. She said honestly, I do not know you. I barely avenged you. You owe me no allegiance, and nor does your cavalier.
Oh, Protesilaus is here because he wouldn't be able to help it, Dulcie said dismissively, putting one of the candles down and, with a total lack of shame, wriggling her hands up into her shirt so that she could warm them on her abdomen.
I love him, but he's such a pest. I wish he hadn't even come with me to Canaan House. I feel horrible. He should have stayed home with his wife and his sons. His wife does tapestries, and he breeds flowers for a hobby. I stayed on their farm right after my pneumonia because they thought the sitting temperature would be better for me. And if I ever see another rose, I shall scream. No chance of that now. Don't worry about Protesilaus. He can't help being so fantastically, dorkily noble.
But you...
Dulcie's smile became ferocious. Her lips curled to show that some of the very white teeth were a little pointed, and her pallid eyes seemed to turn up at the corners. She was no longer languid, but breathless, alive, and resembling nothing quite so much as a malign fairy. Harrow remembered that Palamedes Sextus had made a war of his whole life in order to prosecute his desire to marry this woman.
The only thing that ever stopped me being exactly who I wanted, she said, was the worry that I would soon be dead. And now I am dead, Reverend Daughter, and I am sick of roses, and I am horny for revenge.
Then she took her hands away from her middle and went back to happily fixing the ward. It did not take long to complete the circle. They worked swiftly and quietly. When they finished, the coffin was cocooned in an enormous circle of enmeshed ward and candle anchorage, although Abigail looked discontented.
I hate doing anything to spirits without something to feed them, she said, and there's no real blood here. There's nothing to tempt it. I wish we knew what it was anchoring itself to. What's the thanagetic link, and why has it been able to follow it to you? Harrowhark, you really don't have any insight into who might be haunting you. Do any of its signifiers mean anything? The suit? The blood? The gun?
Harrow's brain, though still a jumble, was no longer a mess in a darkened room. Memory had gifted her a small torch she could light the disarray with. She remembered the clipped cohort accents. A standard-issue infantry sword. A two-hander.
The sword, she said. It's Gideon's, but none of the other signifiers match.
Did the sword belong to anyone before her? Not that I know of. Aglamine petitioned to give it to Griddle from the Dreaber stock. I signed the order. The box was still wrapped. The light was not proving helpful enough. She was, in desperation, kicking over piles of the rubble in her own brain. I hated that damned sword for years. I don't know why. It just felt strange, rancorous. I cannot deny that I often assumed its edge would be the last thing I saw. I don't know, she finished, frustrated. Never mind. I'm sure I've done worse with more, said Abigail bracingly. Get to the perimeter. You're on point with Dulcie, and I'm pairing Magnus with Protesilaus, and then there's Ortus. Ortus shouldn't be fighting. He very much wants to. I hope there won't be any fighting. Are you ready? Hera's lips were sore. Everyone's lips were a little cracked and bleeding, and on her and Ortus's bloody lips and cracking paint blended in a pinkish-grey mosaic. She found the tip of her tongue worrying the little scabby plates that now lived on her bottom lip. She looked up into the kind face of Abigail Pent, who was dead, and she said, I owe you a great debt. You have given me much in return for very little. Oh, Harrow, bless you. I always was a busybody, she said smilingly. Don't thank me for sticking my oar in. You asked me to come, and I came. I understand you didn't ask on purpose, but I like to think that there was a grain in your soul that saw yourself in need, and perhaps thought to itself, I wish I had Abigail Pent. It takes a great deal of ego to be a psychopomp. Thank you for letting me be yours. And she curtsied to Harrowhark with enormous grace. Harrowhark bowed in return and found herself saying, The body of the locked tomb preserve you and yours, Pent. And meaning it. Do you know what's in there? Asked Abigail, eyes sparkling. Harrowhark cleared her throat and said, Yes. Is it intensely mysterious? Yes. God, I love tombs, said the fifth house necromancer. Righto, the curtain lifts. Places, people. In that echoing metal silence, they all moved to make their perimeter around the diagram. Harrowhark had dug big handfuls from Ortus's panniers and stood shod in a crunchy, perfectly pulverized pile of bone. She watched Abigail and Magnus cross on tiptoe, nimbly dodging any line that their shoes might scuff, and in passing, turn and kiss each other gravely. She was not embarrassed to see this intimacy. In fact, she found that it was vaguely interesting to see a marriage play out in front of her. There were many strictures against a necromancer marrying their own cavalier, and whatever road Abigail and Magnus had chosen to walk had been a difficult one. She knew that the marriage had preceded the cavaliership, which perhaps had made it less grotesque for both. They kissed as chastely and briefly as children. Magnus touched her cheek and said quietly, Godspeed, my darling. And she said, You too. That was all. No more and no less. It was still entirely uncertain whether her skeletons could handle this freezing, wretched cold. If she was bound by the rules of her pre-lictor state, it was going to be difficult. The candles wheezed and flickered, but kept burning gamely on. Protesilaus stood opposite his necromancer. Ortus was there beside Harrowhark, a big black-wrapped bulk in her peripheral vision, trembling a little from cold and probable fear. Lieutenant Dias was her opposite. Harrow had told her, back in the laboratory, that Judith Deuterus was alive, and she'd gotten a rather curt, thought so, in reply. Dias had begun to turn away, then surprised Harrow by turning back and suddenly saying, She'll give them hell, in tones that were scarcely less blank, but with an expression that was far from it. Now Magnus stood at the head of the circle, facing the frozen-over coffin. His necromancer did not put herself at any particular point. She had taken a jug in her hands, one of a set that Protesilaus had carried with care down the long facility ladder, and Harrow did not know what had been put inside it.
Here is the libation, for what good it may do, said Abigail. She carefully poured a measure of the jug's contents at the foot of the coffin. A brief spill of thin, milky, whitish liquid pooled at the base, sluggish in the cold. You come to conquer, she said, and spilt another runnel. You come in fury, she said, and spilt another. You come bearing ancient weapons, she said, and another. You come with a sword of the ninth house, she said, and one more. You come to claim a body, she said, and upended the jug and shook out the last pale drops. This is all we know. You helpless ghost, this is not supplication. We came at invitation. Whither did you? I am a spirit caller of the House of the Fifth. I am Abigail for my mothers, Pent for my people. I who died am come in the fullness of my power at the bidding of the lictor you seek to supplant. I will sever the thanagetic link you have to this woman, and I bid you get the hell out. Abigail withdrew her hand from the fat glove and laid it bravely bare on the icy front of the glass-covered coffin. She did not wince from the cold. A chill blue light emanated from beneath that hand, as though somebody were shining a light from beneath the necromancer's fingers. Harrow was struck by a thirst for her rightful power, to understand the theorem through a lictor's eyes. All she could do was watch with her senses dulled. After a moment, the adept said, The ties lead outside this place, Harrow Hark. The spirit is linked to some physical object. Harrow said, Then what? Oh, we can get the spirit out of you, said Abigail. But we can't kick it out of its other anchor. In other words, just because we banish it here doesn't mean we'll necessarily banish it there, outside the river. But let's give a good hard pull and see what emerges. The candles flared. Where before they had burned with a meek yellow flame, now they burned as strong and blue as the spirit magic emanation from Abigail's hands. Abigail asked, Who are you? And with a sodium flare sparking from Abigail's fingers, the lid of the coffin swung open so wide that it wrenched itself off and crashed to the floor. One of the ice-fogged glass panels that had withstood all of Lieutenant Dias's violence burst into a shower of fragments. Abigail stumbled backward, then regained her footing. There was nothing inside. From the passageway just behind Harrow, the corridor that ought to have led to the mortuary, a voice crackled through its hazmask. Nice try. A dry, unassuming click, an enormous blast that rattled around Harrow Hark's ears, and a crunch as the projectile meant for her cracked into the sheet of solid bone she flung upward from behind her feet. The sheet exploded with the impact, sending chips flying through the air and knocking her forward onto that freezing cold floor and its carefully wrought diagram. A familiar spike of pain went through her head, and her temples prickled with blood sweat. Had raising a simple shield really cost her so much? Had her reserves ever truly been so shallow, even in childhood? She rolled to the side, and someone grabbed her arm and hauled her behind the monument. Ortus. Those assembled had run for what cover they could, mainly to the entrance ways of sanitizer, pressure room, preservation. All except Protesilaus. He had unsheathed his rapier and was the last man standing, his cape a greenish-blue in the light of those blazing candles. He had slung the end of his etched metal chain, tied with a faded green ribbon, over the back of his neck. Now the dead cavalier of the Seventh neatly flipped it off one shoulder and whipped the chain into a slow circle next to him, the links making a high-pitched noise as they cut the air. "Don't engage!" cried Abigail. The sleeper stood opposite in its own doorway, hazmask gleaming dully in the candlelight, that enormous wooden stock gun cradled in its arms, the orange of the safety suit screamingly vivid. The sleeper was not, in the end, of any great height or breadth, and the voice that had emerged from that mask was not inhuman. In fact, it was a woman's voice.
"You wizards never learn," said the sleeper.
The noise of the gun jerked up with an ear-splitting bang. Protesilaus had already exploded into motion. With a great deal of grace for such a big man, he leapt to the side and launched the whirring end of his chain out at the orange monster. It looped twice around the barrel and cinched tight. The sleeper simply threw the gun away, and as Protesilaus tried to shake his chain free, there was another in her hands. This one so much smaller that it took Harrow a moment even to realize it was a gun. The sleeper walked forward, firing with each step, the hand gripping the gun supported on her other palm. These shots sounded higher and sharper, like whip cracks. The seventh cavalier spun his chain in front of him, a blurred wheel in the air, and one of the ceiling lights shattered in a rain of sparks. The sleeper tossed this gun to the side, broke suddenly into a run, and threw her has-suited body into a diving handspring, jackknifing feet first off the ground with a fluid agility that would have made even Camilla Hecht erupt in a wild, "Okay." Protesilaus had braced his stance for an attack and had not expected his enemy to move past him. By the time he shifted and started to turn, the sleeper was on her feet again, and yet another gun was in her hand. She pivoted lightly and shot him in the small of the back. A pop. A wet spatter emerged from his abdomen. Protesilaus dropped. Next to Harrow, Ortus moaned in terror. The sleeper turned back toward them, handgun raised, trying to draw a bead, a wisp of smoke trickling from the muzzle. When she found no head or limbs sticking out to put a bullet in, she stepped back, pointed the gun at Protesilaus's prone form and, without looking, fired two more shots. The body jerked, then was still. Dulcie screamed. There was silence, except for Dulcinea's panicked, wheezing breaths, punctuated by a ripping cough. Protesilaus's body lay heavy and unmoving on the cold metal of the facility floor, somehow still more animated in this death than he had been as the empty puppet of the seventh saint.
"Listen to your leader," said the sleeper. "Don't engage. I'm not here for you, but don't think you can't die again. You give me the girl, and the rest of you are free to go back to whatever hell you came from," Abigail said from somewhere in cover. "You must be joking."
The orange-suited figure raised the gun and fired it into the ceiling. Ortus cringed at the noise. Harrow dug her fingers into his arm, though what comfort that could provide she did not know.
"Harrow Hark," called out the sleeper.
The sleeper said it slowly, as though she had never said it before.
"Harrow Hark," as though the syllables were strange.
That was not the most arresting thing about the monster calling her name. It was the untrammelled contempt with which it was said, as though her name itself were a curse. The sleeper said,
"You can't hurt me here. If you give yourself up to me, the ghosts can leave. If not, I end all of you. This is the only bargain. I'm giving you to the count of 10, then the offer expires. 10.
Harrowhark said,
"Who are you?" "Doesn't matter to you. 9.
"I don't negotiate with strangers."
"Doesn't matter to me. 8.
Septimus broke cover. She stayed low, darting from the doorway where she had hidden herself toward the shelter of a bank of instruments, her shadow huge and jumping in the light of the flickering candles. She was only in the open for a second, but the sleeper pointed the little black gun as casually as Harrow might point a finger, and fired. Her orange-wrapped arm flexed with the recoil. Dulcie cried out and fell, her leg knocked out from beneath her. Harrow closed her eyes briefly. Then she began scrabbling through Ortis's panniers, winnowing for the best pieces, her fingertips slick with sweat as Ortis breathed through his teeth.
"7, said the sleeper.
6. 5. My cue, I think, said Magnus Quinn.
Harrow had lost track of him entirely when the shooting started, and had assumed he was with Abigail, who seemed, from her voice, to be somewhere near Dulcinea. Now he emerged from the doorway immediately to the right of the one through which the sleeper had entered. He flung himself at the sleeper from behind before she could turn to meet him, and grabbed her in his arms, locking them tight round her midriff so her elbows were pinned against her sides. From the other side of the room, Marta Dias burst out of her own doorway, bent at the waist. The sleeper managed to wrench her arm far enough to fire from the hip, but the shot pinged into the metal wall with a bright, hot snap. Dias fell into a sideways roll, a much less beautiful movement than the sleeper's impossible handspring, but one that bore the spare efficiency of long practice, and came up holding the big gun with the wooden stock that the sleeper had tossed away. She braced it against her shoulder, looking like a drawing of some ancient soldier on a far-off battlefield, her cohort whites gleaming pale blue in that sea of unearthly candles, and fired. Dias flinched back with the recoil, and a hole split open in the sleeper's orange suit, high in the middle of the chest. But no mist of blood sprayed forth. The sleeper twitched in Magnus's grip, but kept her footing. Dias fired again and again, and two more holes appeared, clustered close with the first. Harrow caught a glimpse of black beneath the bright fabric, but nothing wet or red, and the sleeper was still struggling hard against Magnus's armhold. Dias dropped the gun and ran forward instead, hand flashing to the hilt of the dagger she wore at her side. The sleeper jerked her head back. She was about Magnus's height, so this had the effect of smashing the back of her skull, whatever skull she had under that shapeless hood, into his face. He grunted, but kept his arms locked tight. Dias had almost closed the gap, dagger drawn and eyes narrowed, when the sleeper lifted both legs off the ground, drew her knees up to her chest, and slammed her feet out hard. Her boots struck Dias in the chest as she came charging in. Magnus, unexpectedly left holding her whole weight, staggered and fell backward. All three of them went down together. Dias and the sleeper came back up again with almost equal speed, Dias perhaps a fraction faster, the dagger still in her left hand. She slashed diagonally upward. The sleeper blocked her arm with a bent elbow, then stepped in and kneed her in the gut. Harrow heard her wheeze out a surprised breath. The sleeper stepped through, grabbed Dias's knife arm in some complicated hold, and twisted. The dagger dropped to the chilly metal tiles with a musical clatter. Magnus was struggling to his feet, his mouth and chin scarlet with blood from his nose, reaching for his own rapier. The sleeper dropped Dias in a heap on the floor, flung out one arm, and shot him in the stomach. Harrow hadn't even seen the gun appear in her hand. Magnus crumpled. Abigail screamed. Dias had hauled herself up onto hands and knees, but the sleeper kicked her hard in the ribs, rolling her onto her back. She pointed the gun down at her face. 4, she said. The fallen bulk of Protesilaus VII heaved itself abruptly off the ground, crashing bodily into the sleeper as he rose, knocking her away from Dias. She swung the gun up, but he was already too close. He smashed his bunched-up chain into the side of her head with enough force to shatter bone. It whipped the sleeper's face mask to the side, and she stumbled, the gun slipping from her fingers. Protesilaus loosed the chain and lunged with both arms, and at first Harrow thought he had tried to grab her the same way Magnus had. Then she understood. He had wrapped the chain around her throat from behind, like a garrote, and drawn it tight. Against his muscle, even the sleeper's bulky suit looked small. Blood was pouring freely from three dark, ragged holes in his back, running down his thighs and calves and dripping onto the floor.
"I have known one death," he said hoarsely, "and I swear that I will not know its like again." "Smart boy," rasped the sleeper, her voice still strangely fuzzy, as if she were speaking through a communicator. "Figuring out the limits, are we? Doesn't matter. My rules."
Dias was back on her feet now and had drawn her rapier, but she was hesitating. It looked as though she was waiting to see whether the seventh garrot would have any more effect than her bullets had. The sleeper flicked out her arms as though trying to straighten the cuffs of an invisible robe, and a gun appeared in each of her gloved hands. She reached back, tucked the snub-nosed barrel of the left-hand gun against the outside of Protesilaus's knee, and fired. There was a dull pop. He roared in pain and collapsed to one side as though someone had kicked out a stick he'd been using to lean on. As his chain went slack, Dias lunged in a beautifully clean strike at the sleeper's heart. Her rapier's point drove into the hazsuit and bounced, juddering to the side as though she'd stabbed a solid iron pillar. The sleeper knocked the blade clear with her arm and smashed the butt of her other gun into the cavalier's jaw, dropping her to the floor like a sack of snow leaks dumped from the arms of a tottering drearbird drone. Then she placed her steel-toed boot on Dias's throat. Harrow seized her moment, stood up, and made a long, underhand throw. And the sleeper shot the clump of bone she was forming out of midair. The sleeper's arm moved faster than an arm could move, the bullet more accurate, perhaps, than a bullet could be. As the bone burst into powder, no shape sprang forth. Harrow felt it become inert at the moment of impact, as though the saint of duty had touched it and sucked it dry. A chill settled on her heart. "Three," said the sleeper. "This is easy mode. Do you get it? No magic, no tricks, none of your foul bullshit. I've been doing this for years. The moment I want it to be over, it's all over." Harrow could hear Dulcinea swearing weakly. At least she was alive. She pressed up against the icy side of the coffin and called out over it, "What happens? What happens if you take me?" Ortis said urgently,
"Lady, no!"
The sleeper said,
"You'll die. It doesn't have to hurt. I'm not here to torture anyone."
"And?"
"I get your body."
"And?"
"I finish it."
"Finish what?"
"This isn't a conversation. Two."
Harrow peered over the coffin. Magnus and Protesilaus were both sprawled on the tiles in puddles of blood. Both were moving, but neither showed any signs of getting up. Dias was flat on her back, eyes closed as the pressure from the sleeper's booted foot increased. She made a tight, choking noise, and when one hand frantically patted around for her sword, the sleeper stepped from her neck to her hand with a crunch.
"One," said the sleeper.
Next to Harrow, hidden behind the coffin, Ortus cleared his throat.